Well, you can feel like.
Yes. Senate Committee on the Judiciary, Tuesday, June 1st, 1999, 3 p.m. in
Wednesday. Meeting on Senate Bill 299, and I invite Mark Tegel. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Martha Tegel, Director of the Water Resources Department. We're handing out two copies of my written testimony on Senate Bill 299 and the proposed Dash 5 amendments. Both the bill and the Dash 5 amendments were prepared at the request of our department. They deal with the fairly technical but important issue of how the state deals with pre-1909 water rights that have not yet been adjudicated. And just a very quick background and refresher course that prior to 1909, the state did not have a water code. As of 1909, a person who wanted to make use of water for the state was required to obtain a water right from what is now the Water Resources Department. For people who had vested water uses before 1909, the state law always recognized their right to continue those uses, and there's a process called an adjudication by which those uses are recognized and quantified by the court. We have in Oregon completed the adjudication process on about 70% of the state geographically, but most of that is in eastern Oregon. We have yet to complete the adjudication on the major water basins in the western side of the state, and we're currently in the process of an adjudication in the Klamath Basin. But it's a very lengthy and expensive process that involves our department and the courts and people coming forward in the claims process. What this bill does is provide clear statutory authority for our department to work with pre-1909 water users to recognize changes in their uses, either in the type of use, the place of use, or point of diversion. For people who hold water rights issued since 1909, this is called a transfer, and it's something that they're readily able to do if they meet a test for injury to other water rights. We have, by rule, provided a process for people who are waiting for the adjudication but need to make these types of changes. And we have recently been advised by the Attorney General's office that it would be helpful to have clear statutory authority to make sure that that rule isn't, or that the rule that we have is indeed consistent with legislative intent as to how we treat these pre-1909 uses who are waiting for the adjudication. The bill was filed, pre-session filed, on behalf of our department. It was kind of a placeholder. Since then, we've been working on the best way to articulate this intent, and that's what you have before you in the Dash 5 amendment. The real change is on page 4, which adds a new section to the law that simply states very clearly that we do have the authority to adopt a process and standards for recognizing this type of change, and it also makes clear that any changes that were recognized prior to this time under our existing rules are also not affected by this change. So we would request your support for these changes and for the bill.
As I understand, this bill in part was brought because of the situation City Springfield has, where they need to move a point of diversion. In committee, a point of diversion is where you take the water. And in this case, it's the Willamette River, and that's one of the unadjudicated rivers. Correct?
Sure, that's correct.
And for a variety of reasons where they currently direct or take the water, it's not a good place. The idea is to move it quite a distance where it'll be a better place both environmentally and require putting in a channel where an old channel used to be or something similar to what prior existed. Currently, do you have rules that would allow you to do this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do have rules which were adopted in 1990. They are adopted under the general authority for the Director of Water Resources Department to work with the court in providing this registration process for pre-1909 claims. And our concern is to make sure that we have express statutory authority for this element of the rules which talks about changes in registered uses. People who have these pre-1909 claims had to have, by a certain cutoff date that's already come and gone, registered the use. That is, tell us how much they're using, where they're using it, and for what use. And this allows us to make changes in those registration as needed up to the time of the adjudication. I'd also like to point out, I think there are folks here if you have specific questions about the city of Springfield, but this bill affects hundreds of pre-1909 registered water users outside the city of Springfield. We have received these types of inquiries from a lot of different folks, so it's not just the city of Springfield, but they certainly would be affected by it.
Have the city of Springfield registered their use?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So they'd follow that practice, and the only thing they're trying to do is change the point of diversion, correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct.
Does in any way the Dash 5 amendments change the power that the department has as far as regulating non-adjudicated water rights?
No, Mr. Chair. The Dash 5 amendments, you'll see that Section 2 has a specific reference to any rules adopted by the Water Resources Director prior to the effective date of the Act. The intent there is to recognize and very clearly validate the rules that we have in place, and it is not our intent to change these rules at any time in the near future. We're not anticipating that. The rules do require a process of bringing forward a request for the change, and they do have standards that we have to evaluate whether there would be injury to other water rights or a net change in the way the stream system works, basically. I'm paraphrasing here. But we have had these rules in place, and they give us both a process and standards by which the judge is not supposed to change them.
Are there other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Martha, this is an adjudication issue, but as I understand it, it's also a condemnation issue. Now, the condemnation aspect doesn't pertain to water resources, but this pops up, Mr. Chair, in Water and Land Use Committee. That's why we're dealing with this issue in this committee today, is because of the complications of not only just adjudication, but the condemnation proceeding as well. And Martha, when we move the line of withdrawal, the point of diversion, will that change the date of appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarno, the change would not change the priority date that is claimed in the registration form. Ultimately, that has to go through the adjudication to become the final priority date, but this wouldn't have any effect on that.
Most you indicated that other areas of the state would be impacted by this legislation as well. And I'm kind of wondering to what degree. My concern is then that to pass legislation that not just impacts other regions, but benefits those areas or locales, much of this designed to try to benefit the city of Springfield. In your opinion, will this benefit those regions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hano, yes, I think this bill has general applicability, and I think it can be very important to people who have these registrations who are in areas where we're not likely to adjudicate in the foreseeable future. The Willamette Basin is the key example of that, and the city of Springfield is just one example within that basin of users who are going to have to deal with reasonable changes in their water uses, and we're not likely to get around to an adjudication for 10 years in the Willamette Basin. So I do think it has broad applicability, and it's an important measure. That's why the department has been behind this, because it's not just for a single person, it's for anybody who is similarly situated, and that's most of the west side of the state.
Okay, thank you.
Would this help you in the Klamath Basin?
Mr. Chair, it would not affect the Klamath Basin because it only applies at the registration stage. Once the claims have actually been filed and the adjudication process commenced, then this rule steps back and then they're subject to the judicial process of adjudication itself. So no, it doesn't apply in the Klamath.
Is there anything we can do to help you in the Klamath Basin?
We're speaking with Ways and Means Committee about the help that we need in the Klamath Basin.
Other than money.
Yes. Could you clarify the water rights, I mean not rights, water certificates, water permits, and now there's water registration that are these pre 1909. How? So yeah, there's a registration right then too, is that, how is that?
Chair Senator Nelson, for long-time water users whose rights vested before 1909 when we had our first code, the process that was set up maybe 20 years ago in the statute required them to register to say, I have this pre-1909 claim, and it's for this much water on this particular stream for this particular use, and they have filed that with us. It may be years before we get around to the actual adjudication, which would convert that registration into a certificated water right. And this bill affects their ability to make changes while they're waiting for the adjudication to occur.
Okay. Now, is it true that if you have a certificate of water right or water cost, you can change the point of diversion if you have a certificate, but not if you have a permit?
Yeah. Chairman Nelson, that's basically correct. The law provides a transfer process. If you have a certificated water right or a decreed water right, there's actually a term defined in the statute called a water right subject to transfer. It allows a change in the place of use, the type of use, or the point of diversion. For permit holders, they can only make limited changes as to the place of use, but not as to the type of use. And they may also change the point of diversion, but it's a much more restricted process.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, testimony.
Thank you.
I think we just got the Dash 5 amendments today, is that correct? I'll close the public hearing today and we'll reschedule. I want to give people an opportunity if they have comments on the Dash 5 to bring them forward. I do intend to move the bill, so that will happen, that we'll see if after people review the Dash 5, if there are any other thoughts that might come up. So with that, I'll close the public hearing today on Senate Bill 299. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2660 and invite Representative Lowe. Oh, okay, if you would, please. Oh, okay. She's on her way back. Well, let me maybe move to another one here. Everything well underway. We go into a work session on House Bill 2759 and David Needle. I understand he has some Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Somebody other than just one, will you please? I'm very sorry. I guess I'm very emotional reaction to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have before you House Bill 27. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. I'm a proponent of this bill. You have before you
the A4 amendments to House Bill 2759. These amendments are almost exactly the same as the A2 amendments that you had before you when this bill was heard last Thursday, I believe. The only difference in these is that it gives the courts, in effect, a little bit broader discretion to make rules about the disposition of criminal records checks that they would receive from professional fiduciaries. As you'll recall, this is a bill that requires some disclosures of professional fiduciaries. That's basically people who generally for a fee act as fiduciaries for people to whom they're not related. These amendments, I think, were agreed to by all the interested parties, and I would urge you to adopt the -4A4 amendments and pass the bill out.
Any questions for Ms. Needle on the -A4 amendments? We are in work session. Chair then will move the -A4 amendments to House Bill 2759. Discussion? Objection? Order. Chair then would move House Bill 2759 for to pass as a move. Discussion? Objection? Order.
Who would like to carry it?
Thank you. Senator Burdick will carry it for us.
Really can't if you say you're nothing.
I know. Yep. Now go to House Bill 2760 over the work session, Mr. Needle again, on the -A5.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm David Neeble with the Oregon Law Center, again, a proponent of this bill. The -A5 amendments, again, are very similar to ones you had before you at the public hearing. These amendments, in effect, create a pilot program in Multnomah County, in the Multnomah County Probate Department, to basically add some due process protections to guardianship and conservatorship proceedings. The A5 amendments, there's a change on the page 1, lines 1 and 2, clarify the notice to respondent regarding the request for a court-appointed attorney. It makes clearer that you can request a court-appointed attorney, but one may not be appointed for you. Also on page 1, lines 20 to 21, it gives the court discretion to allow a petitioner to amend a petition that's found to be defective rather than simply having the petition dismissed. On page 2, there's an amendment on line 9, which makes clear that the visitor can only recommend the appointment of counsel rather than determine that counsel could be appointed. On page 6, there's an extraneous section. The first section of what is section 12 was deleted because that's already covered by current law adequately. And finally, there's a sunset date inserted of December 31st, Aud 3, for the pilot program only. Again, I think these amendments were, I'm sure that these amendments are agreeable to all the parties who had an interest in this bill. And I would urge the committee to adopt the amendments and to send it out to the floor.
And this is the one that says, yes, well, testified in favor of?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Yes, we have the -A5 amendment.
I move, are we in work session?
We are.
I move the A5, what was it again?
A5.
You thank you so much. I move the A5 amendments, please.
Senator Cordy moves the -A5 amendments to House Bill 2760. Discussion? Objection?
I move House Bill 27608, amended before due pass recommendation.
Thank you. The motion is presented to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Order. I believe Senator Brown might have had an interest in this. Why don't we allow her that opportunity? Thank you. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2660 and invite Representative Lowe and Gil Thomas to come forth.
Good afternoon, Senators.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm State Representative Kathy Lowe from House District 26, Garden City and Gladstone area, and I brought this legislation at the request of a constituent, and he's seated to my right. His name is Gil Thomas. Actually, Larry Soa, Representative Larry Soa, brought this for him, but the last moments of signing by made the job incomplete, and I'm just following through for the good representative. Mr. Thomas is a small business owner and recently had a situation in which a client stopped payment on a check for no good reason. He'll tell you a little bit more about that, but to make a long story short, he had done some work for her and she had paid him, but before the check cleared, he had done some work for a neighbor and she didn't like the looks of that job. So she stopped payment on the check, which I was kind of rude. There are already sufficient penalties in place for if somebody bounces a check, and we're asking for the same kind of situation, same kind of penalties in place and the same sort of remedies for those who stop payment without good cause. And as you know, good cause is a legal term of art, so there are standards. The bill will not only give citizens a remedy to recover monies legally owed them, but it will also make people think twice before they stop a check, because it imposes the same penalties upon you if you do it wrongfully as for those who write bad checks. I await your questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for anyone? Donna Thomas, you can identify yourself, please.
Yes, sir. My name is Gil Thomas, and I'm a contractor out of Milwaukee, Oregon. I had some testimony that I had put together for you, if that's okay. As Representative Lowe stated, I asked her to introduce this major legislation. I'm a contractor who specializes in a number of services, but particularly in the installation of energy efficient replacement windows. In that role, I learned about the current loophole in Oregon's bad check law. I installed some windows in a customer's mobile home. Upon completing the customer's windows, she informed me she did not have the remaining balance owed. Generally, when I make a job, the balance is due upon completion of the job. Since she told me she could only give me a post-dated check, and with the remedies allowed, it was basically all I could do. She also informed me she was so satisfied with the job that she referred her neighbor to me. I did install a number of new windows for him, which he was very satisfied. When the date came to cash the check, I attempted to cash the check and was unable to cash the check due to her putting a stop payment on it. When I asked her why she stopped payment, she told me she didn't like the work I had done for her neighbor. After being unable to collect the debt, I took the matter to small claims court. So during that experience, I learned all one has to do to get around the penalties of the bad check law is to put a stop payment on the check, regardless of whether there is just cause for doing so. I prevailed in the matter to get the principal owed to me. I was informed, however, I was ineligible to collect damages under the law's current language by the judge. He also suggested the law needed changing. That's why I brought the measure before Representative Lowe and she before you. If this measure becomes law, it will hopefully discourage those who use the current loophole to keep from paying legitimate debts by putting stop payments on their checks. This measure still puts the burden of proof upon the party initiating the action. Any person seeking redress through the courts would first be required to attempt to collect the debts in question before filing any papers. When the issue comes before the court, the person seeking the action would then be required to prove that the maker or drawer has stopped their payment without good cause. Only after the case had been proven would a judge be able to render a decision regarding the statutory damages. Even then, these damages are not automatic. They are administered at the discretion of the presiding judge. This measure doesn't prevent or penalize anyone from stopping payments for just cause, because the burden of proof is still lies with the plaintiff. It's only a housekeeping measure that cleans up an otherwise excellent law. I urge every member of this committee to support this measure and send it out to the full Senate for its consideration.
question.
Other questions for Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chair, if I have kind of a strange look on my face, if I'd like to explain it, I've been sitting here reading this bill, and I've been looking at your testimony and listening to you, and my bill deals with extreme fighting, means of no holds barred match, competition, exhibition, and so forth.
Oh, no, don't tell me I've been dead.
No, again. All of a sudden I realize this also includes last year's 1997.
Kickboxing or something like that.
But I thought it fit pretty well with the extreme fighting.
Thank you,
we're
Senator.
That, anymore,
that was the high point of my day.
Good, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any relevant questions? If not, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2660.
House Bill 2660 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I accordingly move House Bill 2660 to the floor, due pass. Discussion?
Sure.
Yes.
I just had a question, I guess, of you. Who would determine what good cause is in a case like this?
Well, there's case law, and, for instance, good cause would probably be you were defrauded in some way, so that you wrote the check and then realized you didn't get the benefit of what you purchased. So what we're relying on to determine what good cause is case law that has defined good cause. So that's the process that would be used. The fact of Mr. Thomas's case, that he didn't like the work he did next door, wouldn't be a good cause.
You can all agree on that.
And neither is a good cause the fact that you didn't have money in your account at the time. And that's the inadvertent loophole we created by the way we passed it. So, yes.
Yeah. Unless the question wanted to, I would be happy to share it, so Mr. Thomas is going to buy the fish.
Oh, we should.
And I would promise I would try to debate the 1999 bill.
Well,
would you have to
no, no, I think it would be appropriate for you to carry it. Motion carries, and we'll have Senator Duncan carry the bill.
Thank you so much.
You bet. We'll now go to a public hearing on House Bill 2925. Charles Stern. Charles is coming up next week. We will have scheduled 3 days to hear the 8th House Resolution dealing with the Victim Rights Initiative. So we'll probably have 2 days of public testimony and then a work session. Good afternoon, Charles. What do you have for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee dealing with records. I have a bill here that, to some, you may wonder why it's here. In current law, the person, or the minister who wishes to perform marriages must record evidence of his authority satisfactory to the clerk. Well, that's a pretty subjective standard. And so as the various clerks around the state came together, we said we need to have something a little more uniform rather than satisfactory to the clerk. And so we came up with this affidavit form, which was further revised by the Judiciary Committee in the House as they wanted to strengthen some of the languages in it, which was very acceptable to us. Also, over the past few years, we've had requests from some church organizations who defrocked their minister and said, now what do we do to repeal his authority to perform marriages? Well, there was nothing in the law to deal with that. And so we tried to address both those questions in this bill. That's kind of the basic nub of this. What we view as a rather simple bill which deals with some problems.
Didn't we try and do this last session too? Didn't defrocking come into a conversation?
Yes, that is true, sir.
What was that about?
Well, as I recollect the last session, it started through the process and then the clock ran out on us as it's sometimes done this time of year.
I got you. So we were defrocking, but we didn't quite get it through the House and the Senate. Are there questions for Mr. Stewart? he's their only witness, so this is your chance. Senator Tardo.
Chuck, I'm wondering, what do you do if you find out the guy's lying to you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarno, probably the same thing we do right now. It's between the body that, the church body and the minister. We don't do any enforcement now. People submit to us letters, you send $20 down to California and Universal Life Church sends you a little card, bring it in. Some clerks accept that, some won't. Does the church have authority? Is there a church? Those are the questions we're saying. Can we create as much standardization as possible with this affidavit saying, let the church say...
Public testimony in a work session. Good afternoon, Charles. What do you have for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee Dean of Records. I have a bill here that to some, you may wonder why it's here. In current law, the person or the minister who wishes to perform marriages must record evidence of his authority satisfactory to the clerk. Well, that's a pretty subjective standard. And so as the various clerks around the state came together, we said we need to have something a little more uniform rather than satisfactory to the clerk. And so we came up with this affidavit form, which was further revised by the Judiciary Committee in the House, as they wanted to strengthen some of the languages in it, which was very acceptable to us. Also, over the past few years, we've had requests from some church organizations who defrocked their minister and said, now what do we do to repeal his authority to perform marriages? Well, there was nothing in the law to deal with that. And so we tried to address both those questions in this bill. That's kind of the basic nub of this. What we view as a rather simple bill which deals with some problems.
Didn't we try and do this last session too? Didn't the talking come into the conversation?
Yes, that is true, sir.
What was that about?
Well, as I recollect the last session, it started through the process, and then the clock ran out on us, as it's sometimes done at this time of year.
I got it. So we were defrocking, but we didn't quite get it through the House and the Senate. Are there questions for Mr. Stewart? He's our only witness, so this is your chance. Senator Tardo.
Chuck, I'm wondering, what do you do if you find out the guy's lying to you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarno, probably the same thing we do right now. It's between the body that, the church body and the minister. We don't do any enforcement now. People submit to us letters, you send $20 down to California and the Universal Life Church sends you a little card, bring it in. Some clerks accept that, some won't. Does the church have authority? Is there a church? Those are the questions we're saying. Can we create as much standardization as possible with this affidavit saying, let the church say they have that authority? Now, he has his own church. He signs everything. You know, I don't know what you do with those circumstances, but I'm sure they exist.
I remember Flip Wilson and the church and what's happening now.
Yeah.
The only minister and the president of the congregation.
Other questions?
If not,
thank you.
Definitely. Well, the public hearing announced Bill 2925 and open the work session.
I would move.
House Bill 2925 and vote to be passed recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Nelson moves House Bill 2925 to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none? Motion carried. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm carrying my load out.
Yeah.
Not fine. Hey, that's a good one.
Yeah. Right?
She's pretty good one.
I like it. Great. All right. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 2705. And we have three sets of amendments. Ann, you want to walk us through those, please?
Mr. Chair, you actually, at your last hearing, went through the dash 86 amendments are Ministry of Health Conflict with House Bill 2168. And I want to make sure I get the right. A4 amendment are the amendments with regard to the noise issues that we have got to see here.
Also, Paul Remain is the one who requested those. All right. So the dash A6s are the conflict amendments.
Correct.
All right. The chair then would move the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 2705. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Then
the dash A.
This adopts the temporary order that has been approved by the OLCC. No. The chair would move the dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2705.
Mr. Chair, question. I think the dash 4 is also related to the noise activity outside, or is it limited to inside your
town? It is both inside the license plant, only if it is the section, subsection A, and then noise outside caused by patrons is okay. Subsection B. So it covers both. Discussion on the A4 amendment? Okay. Would you please note Senator Burdick as objecting? Motion carried. Then we go to
the A7.
The A7.
Which would specify that there's something I should read out here, but I want to make sure that the bill does not thwart the business like Nordstrom or any other business from giving them a solution.
Take the word. Chair then removes the dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2705. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. Chair then would move House Bill 2705 to the floor due pass. Discussion? Objection? Would you note Senator Burdick as objection? Motion carried. Sure. Thank you.
I'm on a roll.
We will.
I didn't vote on.
We did 2705.
Is it a good bill?
This is the one dealing with LLCC and the
minor possession,
also the noise outside of licensed premises. Would you like to be recorded?
Oh, yes.
Without objection, Senator Courtney would like to be recorded.
Oh, the main bill, right?
As an I or an A vote?
I vote. It's Peter and Paul.
Peter and Paul.
It's Peter and Paul vote.
Right.
So how does Peter vote? He never votes against Paul. It's Peter and Paul. We're together. You know.
I vote A. Aye. Without objection, won't change the outcome. Ordered.
I'm going to change mine now.
By the way, somebody just brought me a cookie. Somebody... And they brought me kisses. Somebody is trying to influence my vote.
Share with the family.
Do you ever have a cookie brought to you, Mr. Chair?
No, I never have. We never have. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2417 and invite Brian Bowen. All right. That's okay. This goes another committee.
Where are you going, man? Oh, that's a screw on that committee. The House Judiciary Committee over us?
Mm-hmm.
We have some reading for another man.
Good afternoon, Mr. Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bowen, and I'm here this afternoon representing the National Association of Independent Insurers, and we're appearing in support of House Bill 2417. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to comment on this important piece of legislation. As insurers, we refer to the concept embodied in House Bill 2417 as the Personal Responsibility Act, because it best describes both the intent and effect of this important measure. Upon passage, House Bill 2417 will provide a consistent and common-sense framework for protecting those drivers who maintain personal responsibility by carrying the insurance required by law, and denies rewards to those who ignore their obligation, break the law, and drive without insurance or under the influence of intoxicants. It does so in a fair and even-handed manner. When a person drives a car without insurance and experiences an accident, they will still be able to recover all their actual losses, including damage to the vehicle, lost wages, and medical expenses. Recovery beyond these actual economic damages would not be available to an uninsured driver under House Bill 2417. This is the essence of our proposal. If you break the law, your ability to recover under our tort system is then limited to your direct economic losses. A person who has avoided their personal responsibility by driving without insurance cannot then come back and access the system they intentionally avoided by lodging a complaint seeking an enormous pain and suffering award. We believe this approach is not only fair, it is also consistent with the intent and severity of Oregon's other laws dealing with uninsured drivers. And I've attached a statute that describes for you the penalties of 1 year suspension for driving without insurance. Previous legislatures have been very clear in setting policy in dealing with uninsured drivers. It is a serious crime. So serious, in fact, that in 1993, the legislature required insurers doing business in Oregon to electronically notify the DMV of all motor vehicle insurance policies issued or canceled to better track and hopefully impact this problem. House Bill 2417 is a logical and appropriate complement to Oregon's uninsured driver statute that not only adds protection for law-abiding citizens, but also encourages those who do not have insurance coverage to obtain it. In past discussions of this concept, the argument has been raised that it discriminates against those who cannot afford insurance. We believe this argument is misguided and untrue. Such a statement speaks to the underlying requirement that all drivers in Oregon carry a minimum amount of auto liability insurance. The merit of that statute is not a question currently before the committee. What is before the committee is the question of fairness between those who obey the law and those who do not. Now, in closing, I'd like to cite briefly a scenario that incorporates many of the elements we're discussing here. A low-income individual who could not afford the full insurance package, such as collision, uninsured motorist coverage, and other optional coverages, still meets her obligation under the law and purchases the minimum liability coverage. This person then accidentally rear-ends a person driving without insurance, damaging her own vehicle in the process. Under current law, the legal insured driver, being at fault, would have no recovery and bear the cost of repairs to the person's own vehicle. On the other hand, the illegal uninsured driver could recover all of their damages, including non-economic damages like pain, suffering, and inconvenience attributable to the accident. There is something inherently unfair about the exposure the legal insured driver experiences in this scenario. House Bill 2417 would correct this and reserve the tort system for law-abiding persons rather than lawbreakers. It's important to note that this same law was adopted in California by ballot measure with a yes vote of almost 80%. Both insurers and regulators attribute decreased costs for the insurance buying public and increased numbers of previously uninsured drivers obtaining insurance. In addition, all of the major auto riders in that state filed for rate reductions within 6 months of the measure's passage. Again, I'd just like to thank the chair for the opportunity to present this information, and we urge the passage of House Bill 2417. Mr. Chair, the House did adopt some amendments, and if it's your pleasure, I could briefly address the amendments the House added to the bill in their deliberation.
Yes, if you would, please.
The House...
yes, Senator Courtney has a question.
No, let him finish. Let him finish. Because you're on a roll. I don't want to...
Thank you, Senator Courtney. I don't know if I'd describe it as a rule, but the House was concerned about someone who may have inadvertently had their coverage lapse, communication between spouses and sending the check in or any of that kind of thing. So what the way that they sought to remedy that problem was to put a 30-day window in which the prohibition, if an accident took place, the prohibition on recovery of non-economic damages would not be barred. Now, if you add this to the grace period that insurers already allow, and I did some research into this when the bill was before the House committee, which are anywhere from 15 to 30 days, that essentially adds a 45 to 60-day window should there be any case where someone finds themselves inadvertently for some circumstance uninsured. The other concerns that they addressed in the House amendment that if the defendant, the person that was at fault, was also intoxicated, and this is important to remember, this bill covers not only driving uninsured, but under the influence also. But if the defendant was also intoxicated, then the bar on recovery of non-economic damages would not apply. And the prohibition would not apply if the defendant was cited for reckless driving and causing the accident. And finally, the bar on recovery would not apply if the person was committing a felony or an intentional tort at the time of the accident. And the House felt that those amendments made a complete package and moved the bill.
Senator Courtney, you had a question.
If you don't have insurance, does that mean an automatic suspension of your license?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, if you are cited, yes, for 1 year.
Okay. Yes, Senator Duncan.
I don't think you have to be cited.
If they discover.
Yeah.
Yeah, correct.
Due process, you'd have to be decided, though, because you'd be entitled to the opportunity to say, I had insurance, I just hadn't provided the proof of it or something. So you'd have to go through that legal process in order to...
Well,
what happened then was, for some other reason, the insurance was required to be posted to the motor vehicle department, and when it lapsed, then they send out an automatic notice. For instance, there's a... If you have a DUI in your record for a period of time, you have to post, and I forget the number.
Right.
And if that form ever lapses, you need to get a notice saying your license is required to provide the insurance. That would be. Max Williams sent over some Dash 8.2 and 8.3 amendments dealing with a notice requirement that the Department of Transportation would be required to send out to inform drivers in simple language that they don't have insurance that this could result in their right to recover non-economic damages. And also at all insurance issue liability issue policies must include a copy of that notice when they send out their renewal or cancellation. Which seems like a pretty simple amendment, but then you got a note from let's say council that this probably couldn't be covered by the gasoline tax money for our transportation, so they may need an additional appropriation in order to send out the notice unless it was with their normal renewal or other function. I have no idea what that would cost. Has that been a discussion that you've
had? Mr. Chair, Representative Williams must have erred in not discussing that.
Okay.
I'm sure there would be a significant fiscal attached with that.
And the reason the gasoline tax couldn't apply is because it's a category of expense and in the Constitution. The gasoline taxes can be used for that type of expenditure.
So if we did wanted to include a notice, it would have to be something that would, they just add to some, a notice that goes out now that wouldn't cause any additional expense. Yes, it's very fair.
Brian, don't most of the insurance companies give you notice in advance? I know mine does. They will notify me to trade and go ahead at the time and go ahead and follow through.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Toronto, in fact, you're correct. They do provide notices prior to the renewal date that you have a renewal date coming up, and then you receive an invoice, and then the invoice triggers the grace period that I referred to later on that. And I would add, Mr. Chair, in terms of notification, that any renewal of driver's licenses and registrations does require proof of insurance. I think if Representative Williams is concerned that the public generally be aware of the requirement, there is provision.
You could incorporate it with that notice for no additional postage if you're throwing it off whatever your computer printing is. The Evergreen Committee, I have a letter dated today from Chip Lazenby, and I'll make copies and share with the committee, where he expresses concern about the bill, and in particular the 30-day policy lapse, and instead suggests a period of 180 days. I think this is in the case not of the DUI, but of someone who gets in an accident who is uninsured. Mr. Bowe, would you like to make any comments on that proposal?
Well, Mr. Chair, we believe that with the inclusion consideration of the insurer's grace period that they provide, essentially providing a 45 to 60 day window, is more appropriate than 180 days. We're concerned about the message that sends as a deterrent. We've tried, I think the House Committee tried and successfully addressed that whole issue of an inadvertent or unintentional lapse to the best they could, and I really don't see what we get by extending it to 180 days, and we would not be supportive of that.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions, Mr. Ball? Yes. Senator Rudy.
Right now, if someone is at fault and they're not insured, then they don't qualify for these benefits anyway, right?
Correct.
Okay, so you're dealing with a situation here where it's only the only people affected by this bill would be the people who are not at fault when the accident occurs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, that is essentially correct.
Okay, so how often is this happening, where people are either drunk or without insurance, and they're getting in accidents that are not their fault and collecting huge awards?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it happens more than one might suspect. Oregon's DMV estimates that somewhere between 10 and 14% of the driving population drives without insurance. And if you extrapolate from that the accident rate, it does happen. And in fact, what prompted it in California was that there were severe abuses going on of this, and there were advertisements on the television, different trial attorney firms advertising that we collected this award for a person who didn't even have insurance. And the measure down there was brought by the insurance commissioner in the form of a ballot measure, as I mentioned, to address the problem. So while Oregon doesn't experience the rate of uninsured driver that California does, because we've been able to control our insurance rates here pretty effectively, it is a significant problem that we feel needs to be addressed.
Friday, and I just went on a drive along in Northeast Portland, and it seems like that night no one was driving with insurance, and all their cars got towed away. We had about 4 cars towed away.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there are already some pretty severe sanctions for driving without insurance, so I'm just wondering how this extra layer is needed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it is a situation that the current law does take very seriously. And as I mentioned in my testimony, we feel that this is an appropriate complement to that in terms of discouragement. And again, we're not trying to aim this bill at the unintentionally or inadvertently insured person. What our intent is to get at the chronically uninsured person, the person perhaps like some of those people who were cited that night that you went on the ride-along. Kula have bad driving records. They're aware of the requirement to carry insurance, but they just don't do it because they don't want to bother with the expense. The chronically uninsured person is the target of this bill, and we think it will be effective in addressing that.
Other questions? Thanks for your testimony. Next, I'd invite Nick Alexander. Nick's coming up. I was practicing law with your partner, Neil Latham, the other day, and it was a late evening phone call, and he said, oh, by the way, afterward, he says, I was supposed to lobby you on some issue, but he says, I can't remember what it was. So just to let you know, you're a much more effective lobbyist than your partner, because I know you'll remember what you wanted him to talk to me about. And
I'll have to talk to him again. Well, I'm Nick Alexander. I'm here. I'm the legislative chair of the Oregon Travelers Association, the legislative committee, and I'm here speaking in opposition to House Bill 2417. I do have a prepared memo that will be distributed to you. I think that this bill illustrates, and in fact in the amendments, and I testified in the House and there were amendments, and I think the amendments did help to ameliorate some of the harshest parts of the bill, but really pointed out that when you try to legislate these individual cases, you run into a lot of difficulties because you can't address the various situations that are going to arise. And speaking of the uninsured motorists, I think that the idea that this will encourage more people to get insurance, I think someone came up with some sort of statistics that supposedly backed that, but I think any of us from our common sense knows that if you're looking at, no one thinks about non-economic damages and whether they can recover, and they don't even know the difference, and that's not going to change who is insured and who is not insured. What it's going to mean is that insurance companies aren't going to have to pay when their insureds who are at fault cause serious injury to someone who is not at fault. So let's get down to what the bill is about. That's what it's about. That means when you have $1 million policy and you rear in somebody who's sitting at a stop sign, or you T-bone them and they happen to not have insurance and you cripple them, you're not going to have to pay a lot of money. And the insurance company isn't going to have to pay a lot of money. And that's what the bill's about. It's not going to get more people to buy insurance, the people who are too poor to buy it, or the people whose spouse didn't buy it, or anything else. So if that's the policy that you want to portray, I think that we should set it straight. That's what the policy is. It prevents them from having to pay high losses because someone who was not at fault happened to not have insurance. I think the testimony at the House was something like the idea of the bill. It wasn't the Personal Responsibility Act. At that time, I think the term was no pay, no play, because this is all a game about playing in the tort system, and people are seriously injured, and that's what it's really about. I think if you penalize people for their status to that extent, that could happen in an extreme case, it's very harsh public policy, and it's very wrong public policy. And I'm not defending people who are not insured. Everyone ought to have insurance. But that should not relieve a tortfeasor who cripples or kills someone from having to pay non-economic damages. And I don't think that this body should go out of here with the idea that you have advanced some really fine public policy, because I think it's a very poor public policy. Even on the issue of driving while intoxicated, no one supports someone driving while intoxicated. And the court system treats that very well, because if you come in and you're bringing an action, you're a plaintiff and you're intoxicated, that's going to get before a jury. And I would like to have a statistic of how many plaintiffs who are intoxicated recovered. And in fact, the only time they might recover is when someone else is grossly at fault. And some of the amendments to the House bill might be able to address that effectively, but who knows? Because from our seats here today, we can't anticipate all of those scenarios that may arise. But the system anticipates it and deals with it and treats it in a very effective manner. The other thing that the amendments don't address, if you think that this is an appropriate bill, they address the situation where the plaintiff is uninsured or intoxicated, and the defendant then is also uninsured or intoxicated, and they say this limitation doesn't allow What about when the plaintiff is totally faultless? In other words, he is neither uninsured nor intoxicated, and he gets into an accident with someone who is intoxicated or uninsured. There's not even a situation there where that defendant is not allowed to assert comparative fault against the plaintiff. In other words, he can still say, well, plaintiff, you were at fault more than I was, and he can try to reduce the recovery. And we could have amendments to address that bill. But there's a reciprocity if both sides are in violation of the law, but there's not any reciprocity if the plaintiff is totally blameless and this person is driving uninsured, and the plaintiff can't bring that up and say, hey, you can't tell me I'm at fault. You can't blame me for the accident. That doesn't happen at all. I just think that when we try to anticipate all these situations and fine-tune legislation to address all these scenarios, Mr. Bow can come up with scenarios, and I can come up with scenarios, and we can come up with a million of them. And if we sat here until doomsday, we would understand, frankly, we'd all understand that a bill like this can't really address all those situations, but one thing can. The court system can and does, and it can listen to all the facts and address those situations. And making a blanket penalty, and I think some of the questions about, we have penalties for driving uninsured. Driving uninsured has nothing to do with an accident. I mean, what is more important, having insurance or driving properly? And what you're saying here is what is more important is having insurance, regardless of how you drive, whether it's a $25,000 policy or a $1 million policy. And I don't think that's really the expression that we want to come out of the legislature, that what is most important is to be insured, not how you drive your car, not whether you harm people. It's most important if you have insurance. It certainly is important. We certainly support people having insurance. But I don't think that this bill addresses the situation properly. It also sends what I think is a very, very tainted message. Because if you're a wage earner and you're driving uninsured and you're making a lot of money, you're making $1 million a year, you can recover millions of dollars. But if you're not a wage earner, if you're the finest person in the world, if you're a homemaker or a student or someone that is of very modest means and can be a saint, you recover.
An action where a plaintiff and you're intoxicated, that's going to get before a jury. And I would like to have a statistic for how many plaintiffs who were intoxicated recovered. And in fact, the only time they might recover is when someone else is grossly at fault. And some of the amendments to the House bill might be able to address that effectively, but who knows? Because from our seats here today, we can't anticipate all of those scenarios that may arise. But the system anticipates it and deals with it and treats it in a very effective manner. The other thing that the amendments don't address, if you think that this is an appropriate bill, they address the situation where the plaintiff is uninsured or intoxicated, and the defendant then is also uninsured or intoxicated, and they say this limitation doesn't allow. What about when the plaintiff is totally faultless? In other words, he is neither uninsured nor intoxicated, and he gets into an accident with someone who is intoxicated or uninsured.
there's not even a situation there where that defendant is not allowed to assert comparative fault against the plaintiff. In other words, he can still say, well, plaintiff, you were at fault more than I was, and he can try to reduce the recovery. And you could have amendments to address that bill. But there's a reciprocity if both sides are in violation of the law, but there's not any reciprocity if the plaintiff is totally blameless and this person is driving uninsured, then the plaintiff can't bring that up and say, hey, you can't tell me I'm at fault. You can't blame me for the accident. That doesn't happen at all. I just think that when we try to anticipate all these situations and fine-tune legislation to address all these scenarios, Mr. Bowe can come up with scenarios, and I can come up with scenarios, and we can come up with a million of them. And if we sat here till doomsday, you'd understand, I think we'd all understand, that a bill like this can't really address all those situations, but one thing can. The court system can and does, and it can listen to all the facts and address those situations. And making a blanket penalty, and I think some of the questions about, we have penalties for driving uninsured. Driving uninsured has nothing to do with an accident. I mean, what is more important, having insurance or driving properly? And what you're saying here is what is more important is having insurance, regardless of how you drive, whether it's a $25,000 policy or $1 million policy. And I don't think that's really the expression that we want to come out of the legislature, that what is most important is to be insured, not how you drive your car, not whether you harm people, but it's most important if you have insurance. It certainly is important. We certainly support people having insurance. But I don't think that this bill addresses the situation properly. It also sends what I think is a very, very tainted message. Because if you're a wage earner and you're driving uninsured and you're making a lot of money, you're making $1 million a year, you can recover millions of dollars. But if you're not a wage earner, if you're the finest person in the world, if you're a homemaker or a student or someone that has very modest means and can be a saint, your recovery is substantially limited. And so the public policy that you're sending to people is, if you make money, you're worth money. If you don't, you're not. And that's what I think the public policy that you send to the public by this bill is. If you make money, you're worth money. If you don't, you're not. Because you limit non-economic damages, but not economic damages. When we talk about actual damages, maybe there isn't any damage in pain and suffering. When I hear somebody say they get their actual damages, it's like these other damages are fake. And they're not.
Non-economic damages would include your medical expenses, lost wages.
Correct.
What other types of damages are non-economic?
Lots of services you could maybe include in that, but basically it's going to be, and property damage that was mentioned, which is not usually a difficulty. But I'm always struck by the idea that a wage earner who makes a lot of money is not going to be harmed by this bill very much. He's probably going to have damages in excess of most policy limits anyway. But the housewife, the student, the people who don't have that sort of wage earning capacity, you're telling them, we're going to take away what is the bulk of your recovery, and you're going to tell somebody who makes money, we're not going to take away much of your recovery at all.
Thanks, Bernie.
Excuse me. I want you to help me with this bill. It just occurred to me, I wonder if it's the O.J. Simpson type bill. If it's the incident, it's the accident, or you find out the person's intoxicated or they've tried it out of insurance because it's an accident, and the police show up, and it has to be an accident. It can't be a subsequent accident to each fact, right? If the driving under the influence or the lack of insurance has to be at the moment the accident takes place. Is that correct? Is that your view of the way the bill is written?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, that would be my understanding.
Okay.
It has to be the status at the time.
Right, because I'm not sure. All right. Now, the bill says, I'm looking at Ann Gross House Bill 2417. Is that correct, Mr. Chair? That's the bill.
Yes.
All right. If you get lines 10 to 15 or 16 on page 1, if there's a criminal conviction of either or both, then that says it all in terms of this bill. You've got a criminal conviction for driving under influence, or you have one for not having a driver's license. Then you've got the criminal thing that's going in your favor, is the defendant, right? I mean, that's how the bill's written. Is that pretty much it?
If the plaintiff has been convicted of one of those, then the defendant gets the benefit.
They just wait, they get the benefit, right.
Or if they haven't been
convicted. No, just stop right there, i.e. O.J. Simpson. Criminal law, criminal case, not guilty. Okay, let's say they found not guilty of driving under the influence, or not guilty of driving without insurance. The way this thing's written, you can go into court as a defendant, if I'm not civil proceeding,
right.
And if you have the ability by preponderance of evidence, you can start all over again to show that they were driving under the influence or driving without insurance and get the benefits of saying, in effect, the person, you know, I don't have to pay 95. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corton, that, again, is the way I read it, because the defendant has the opportunity to then prove by a preponderance if there hasn't been a criminal conviction, and it doesn't address whether there's been an acquittal. It only says if there is a conviction, then it's the conclusive presumption that you had committed the offenses. So I agree with that. I think that's the way it works. And again, every time you start discussing scenarios, you come up with, and I had never thought of that.
Well, isn't that what it reads? I just found myself reading these lines. I mean, I don't know, you're certified smart as a chair. I found this a very interesting paragraph, 10 through 16, in terms of the potential here for two bites of the apple, one criminal, one civil. I find it interesting that for some whatever reason, this takes regular drunk driving. This really bothers me. They don't make it. They don't make it. They just short of 0.08. Well, obviously at 0.06, but the economic interest around here, the big lobby, stopped 0.06. So they're somewhere between 0.06 and 0.08. They're drunk as a skunk. They're impaired. Okay, so they don't make it. They can then come in a civil case, though, and in effect, through positive evidence, create enough value, whatever they feel were drinking, enough to be impaired, that they, in effect, get to raise this defense. And that is the second part of our paragraph, and you pretty much said, and I don't know, but Mr. Chair, that seems to me what's in here, and I find that very, very fascinating.
Nick, in a situation where there has been drinking, even if there hasn't been a conviction, the fact that there's been drinking is admissible in evidence. Is that correct?
I think it's almost always. I can't imagine. Again, there may be a situation where it might not come in, but you're always looking at lookout, control, speed, and the cases basically say that if you're drinking, that is going to be evidence of your ability to maintain a proper lookout, control, whether or not you were technically intoxicated at the time or not. And I seriously, I don't know of it. I mean, there may be one out there. In fact, when this bill, when I was talking about it in my legislative committee at OTLA, well, I said, I've never really heard of a plaintiff who's been drinking who's recovered. And so one of the committee members said, I've got a young kid, you know, had like a .08, wasn't doing anything. Somebody else, you know, rams into him at 100 miles an hour. She said, I've got that case right now. And I don't know that that's a total accurate representation, but what I'm saying, probably if you presented that in court and those were the facts, they might allow that plaintiff to recover because somebody else wasn't necessarily reckless, wasn't intoxicated, but was going 95 miles an hour. Well, I mean, we treat those things quite well, and we don't have any of these horror stories about, you know, people staggering drunk, getting into accidents, and recovering big money judgment. And if it happened one time in a lifetime, if somebody thought that, so what? I mean, there must have been a lot of facts there that made a difference to the people who actually heard the case. And we're trying to anticipate cases. We're not hearing any of these cases, and we're penalizing people right out of the box for a status, and we don't know how it contributed to an accident, what the other people were doing, or anything else. I mean, I have a problem with it, obviously.
In your experience of 20-some years practicing law, how many times do you think you've personally represented people in personal injury lawsuits who have not had insurance?
Yeah, I mean, part, I'm even trying to... Most of the people haven't. I mean, the figure that somebody got 10 to 14% uninsured, that's probably accurate, and I would think in my practice that the people I represent without insurance would probably fall below that statistic. But, you know, I have to admit I'm guessing that I'm just trying to think of going through my file cabinet right now, and I can't think of anyone that I have that didn't have insurance. I'm just not sure. I mean, it has, It would happen occasionally. There's no question. But they're not going to recover unless the other side is fault.
I also want to correct the record on in Sunil Latham's not in two out of the doghouse.
Yeah, you agree. Yeah, I know.
Somebody
in the archives.
I think it, by the end of the conversation, he did remember one of the bills, and that dealt with court reporters. It partly came back to him. Okay, Courtney.
This isn't really a fair question to you. It's a better question, Mr. Bill. If you have a drunk drive conviction on your record, or you're driving on insurance, what does that do to your insurance coverage in terms of in the future? I mean, what happens then?
Well, I know if you have a DUI, I mean, it's expensive if you can get it.
If you can get it.
And you're probably going to get a minimum policy, but I doubt you can afford much more than a minimum policy. But I can't really express a lot of expertise or something important.
And can we assume that then, if you get civil conviction, even though this, I'm calling it a civil conviction because of the language that's in here, because if you understand what I'm saying,
yes, I already say,
I don't know if it's actually accurate. I guess I can assume that that's going to be another situation arises where you get a minimum coverage that's going to be difficult to come by. But you probably don't know that. That's not a fair question to ask.
Yeah, I don't know that. We haven't had civil convictions for DUI ever before.
I'm not sure this is, the president cares on me to say it. I'm not sure. You know why I call it civil. You understand why I call it
civil convictions?
Yeah, and there'd be some kind of record that showed that even. Okay.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony. We'll close the public hearing. And I would now like to go to House Bill 2768, and I'd invite Phil Donovan, Lori Lang, and Tim Martinez forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Donovan, representing the Oregon Equipment Rental Association, and for the speak to the bill, we're in support of House Bill 2758. This approves law by clarifying who has the right to bond off a marine. 2758 harmonizes the law, if you will, who can post the bond and who shall pay the bond, and applies to bonds filed on or after the effective date. That said, if I could speak to the letter that you see before you, signed on by myself, Roy Long, and the Associated General Contractors, and the two gentlemen to my left, is a letter in which this bill, when it first came forward, created a lot of, I guess we could say, controversy, and Chair Shetterly sent us to a work group. The legislation before you today represents the consensus that we found within House Bill 2758.
That includes Mr. Kapori?
No, that does not include Mr. Kapori.
Okay.
But in doing so, it was not our intent to create a vehicle for future construction lien law amendments amongst ourselves or others, and wanted to bring this forward to your attention because this issue of construction lien law is one that's been contentious when its modifications come up. With that, I would conclude my comments to the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Unified Electrical Contractors. We are in support of House Bill 2758, the engrossed version of the bill. We haven't had time to really evaluate the impact of the A4 amendments before you today, but as Mr. Donovan stated, this was put together in a work group on the House side, consensus between all of the construction related organizations coming up with something we can all agree on.
The A4s, or excuse me to interrupt, but which are expedited debts, are they coming out of me? You don't know.
Yes, okay. Mr. Chair, that is from Mr. Kapoor. I believe he'll come up and speak.
No, that's fine. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Where did I get the idea of this going to the architect?
Right. Everything starts with the architect. Go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, to answer Senator Duncan's question, there was another bill on the House side, which I believe Mr. Kifori is trying to put into this bill, but I'll have him speak to that. It has nothing to do with the current
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I wish before you today was 2758 as introduced, but what you have here is 2758A in growth. And as my colleagues have mentioned, that is a compromise that was reached, not with Mr. Kifori's involvement, I will add, but was reached on the House side in order to make some very minor tweaking to the construction lien law. Our intent is, and we've all agreed to this, as has AGC, to make this an interim project and go back and look at all construction lien statutes. And that has not been done since 1989, and we think it's time it needs to occur so we don't come here every 2 years and fight out in front of you, but we can come in 2001 with some kind of an agreement. So we would respectfully request that the amendments Mr. Kifori is proposing that they not be adopted and that that be part of the discussion that we have in this next interim, and that she move 2758 to the floor as it currently stands before you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Any questions? Thank you.
Okay.
You're short, concise, and to the point of person. Okay. Mr. Kifori and Diana, would you want to come up and everybody together? Are you together? You step up here too, please. You know, this idea that they can just be there and look at you and make you wonder what they're thinking. I don't know, you know.
Well,
Chair Courtney and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Diana Madrid, and I'm the Executive Director of the Architects Council of Oregon, which is the state chapter of the American Institute of Architects, which is a professional association for architects in this country. I'm going to give you a little bit of history on House Bill 2991, which was the bill that Mr. Smith referred to, maybe the wrong last name. And then I'm going to explain what our amendment does. House Bill 2991 was a bill that would clean up the current architect union that's in the statute in 87.010. It had some problems in the House as far as time. The House committee was not opposed to the idea, but it did fall short of the deadline, and it was suggested by Representative Federley that we work with the people sponsoring House Bill 2758 to make an amendment. As far as I know, there was a conversation that took place and a perceived approval of us amending this bill, and apparently that is not the case. So, moving on to what we think
of... That's not the case?
Well, as I heard today that was not the case, I was told by Mr. Kifori that there was a conversation that took place and that the proponents of this bill didn't have a problem with us putting an amendment in, and I was told today that was not the case, there was no such agreement.
Well, I love these moments. They're back. They're going nuts, shaking their heads. Great, that's fine. I'm there. Something's definitely not right.
I wasn't a party to the conversations, and so I don't know. What the architects are trying to do with this is clean up a really unclean main law. I'm not a lawyer, and so I'm not one to explain name laws. The gentleman that was going to attend today, Sean Baker from Charles Joseph Schrader, he is a construction attorney and he's also an architect, and he is the one who drafted House Bill 2991. It is our intention only to make the architect lien that is currently in statute easier for architects to use. We do not intend to slowly slow down. We are not creating a new lien. Basically, the owner will be responsible for the services that they have asked for unless they notify the provider that they will not be responsible. I'm unaware and I'm unclear of the concerns that the opponents have to this amendment, but we don't intend to change the bill as far as it affects them. We're just trying to clean up our own portion of the lien. If you have any questions, I feel free, happy to answer those.
Are there questions? I apologize.
No, that's okay.
For not hearing justice. I only intended to go to the restroom, but I...
Oh, you don't need to.
Come back that quickly. There's lobbyists out there in that hallway.
I love.
So, any questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. What we'll do on this is allow people to absorb the proposed amendments and comment on those. And so we won't go into work session.
I'm not going to show you.
You're not so sure what?
Well, they were the work group that did something on progress. I'm not so sure that there needs to be another work group that includes more people. We can hear some very interesting testimony. What's really going on in the world? And some stuff there.
You'll have to fill me in.
Yeah, I will. I'm going to have some work.
All right. Thank you. We will now. Okay, well, I hope you have better success than I. We'll now go to a work session on 3509, and let's see. Elizabeth Shank, I'll send you a note. I see a familiar face in the audience. That, why don't we begin with that? Read Elizabeth's note, it's handwritten. So as we discussed on Friday morning, the department would like to testify on 3509, although we don't need any amendments, we want to talk to the committee about the significance of our collection efforts and the long-term voluntary compliance. Thank you for your wonderful understanding. I made that last part up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Browning with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and I really do appreciate on Ms. Harshenko's behalf the courtesy extended to the Department of Revenue. And Ms. Harshenko said in her note, basically we wanted to talk with you a little bit about the impact of House Bill 3509 and the department's efforts to voluntary compliance. We believe we can function under either the Dash 6 or the Dash 7 amendments that you had to House Bill 3509. They did give the Department of Administrative Services more flexibility to consider the circumstances of each agency, so that was really important for the Department of Revenue. But I wanted to point out, because we want to be forthright and no surprises, that we will be talking to the Department of Administrative Services about getting an extension for some of our tax debt, no matter how old it is. And that leads into the discussion of voluntary compliance. We thought it was important to bring that discussion to you because, as Mr. Marquis mentioned, I think he gave a figure of $500 million is the state general fund accounts receivable. The Department of Revenue has about $300 million of that. So we have a pretty big stake in House Bill 3509 from the general fund aspect of it. We have about 60%, so that's a pretty major aspect. We are very supportive of the increased reporting. We think that's a good step, and we will comply with that 100%. You do need the data to make better decisions and hold the agencies accountable. The issue that we're concerned about is the one-year timing of the signed accounts because of the type of accounts we're dealing with tax debt. And the inflexible assignment that would have, the impact that would have on compliance. The Department of Revenue does collect about 95% of all the state's general fund, the $10 billion out there. And all but about 3% of that comes in voluntarily. So it's real important to us that we keep that 3% at that level or even decrease if we can, because it is a very much a voluntary system that we have in the Department of Oregon for collection of taxes. And the difference we saw with House Bill 3509 is that we basically, the Department of Revenue and private collection agencies have very different missions, and that's where we have the area of concern we just wanted to express to you, is that the mission of a private collection agency obviously is collection of debt. The Department of Revenue, we have collection of debt, but the larger aspect of it is compliance, which includes the education and tax credit assistance piece of it. And so that includes past debt owed and future tax system compliance as well. When we're collecting past debt, we don't only want to get the money in the door. We want to make sure that those people come into compliance and understand what they did wrong, work to correct it, and so they will learn the error of their ways if that's the issue. Because we're going to be dealing with that person 20, 30 years down the road. They aren't going anywhere. If they're Oregon residents, we need to have them paying their taxes and paying them timely.
One of the big issues that we wanted to touch upon with you was the issue of withholding, because that is a big issue with businesses in Oregon, especially with smaller startup businesses. Some of these companies take the money that the employees have entrusted in withholding to use as their operating expenses, for instance. And it's really important for us to get them current with their withholding and then work on the past debt. So oftentimes we're working with the company to make sure they realize that this is not the appropriate way to run their business. They can't do that. And then we'll work with them to get their debt caught up. So sometimes it's kind of old. But we think that's important from the viewpoint. You want to keep the company alive and well if we can, because it's providing jobs. And so it touched upon here that they want taxpayers to pay voluntarily every year's tax debt. So that does take time. And it comes with direct contact with the taxpayer, so we can explain what it's to our revenue agents or our auditors what we did wrong and help them to come into compliance. So from the department's viewpoint of long-term compliance and collection, it's time well spent. So the point we have is if we take care of one person permanently, we won't have to pursue them year after year. So it's worth a little bit more time to clear that up. House Bill 3509 does cut short the time. If you don't get payment on the liquidated account after 1 year, it must be sent to a private collection agency. There is some latitude in the bill now, and with the amendments to -6 and -7, we will be working with staff to take that into account as well. But the Department of Revenue is concerned it could affect the department's operations, because right now, we look at each account separately, what we should do with it, whether it includes going to private collection agency or not. And I want to stress that, and put in the perspective of your view of House Bill 3509, the department does collect about 97% of all tax deficiencies assessed. So we have a pretty good track record over time. We do have about $160 million in accounts that have not had a payment in a year. And that sounds like a huge number until you break it down. The $40 million of that is currently right now assigned to private collection agencies. So that's about 40,000 accounts we have out of private collection agencies. We have another $25 million we can't work because it's on legal hold, whether it's bankruptcy or appeals or that type of thing. We cannot do that because of the legal implications. So the remaining $95 million is really what's sitting out there with no payments in a year. And this is primarily hardship in the filing enforcement cases. It includes murder things as well. But these are the tougher cases for us to deal with. And so we're confident over time we can collect those as well. I talked with you a little bit about these cases previously when we talked about the department's bill for pseudonyms and mail theft. We talked a little bit about the filing enforcement cases. So the hardship ones are probably are troubling as well. We have a good example of a recent one of that where you have an older woman who was trying to get her and her husband into compliance, and they were looking to set up a payment plan. Well, unfortunately, he passed away, and this woman has never worked outside the home. So right now she wants to pay the debt, but she needs a little bit more time to kind of get everything in order and work to pay it off. It's going to take a little bit of time. But it's important that she pays that and works to get current. The ones that we talked about with you before were the filing enforcement ones. Those sometimes drag on for a long time and are very, there's a lot of money out there right now. And the $95 million, a lot of those probably are filing enforcement cases. They're very complex. They involve trusts oftentimes or individuals who are hiding their assets. So it's not something you can simply send to a private collection agency, and I don't think they probably would want them, as a matter of fact. But that's a large part of the $95 million, the hardship in the filing enforcement. So these are tough cases, but we think it's real important for the health of the system that we keep working on those. We hear from people who complain about paying their taxes all the time, but they grumble a lot, but as long as their neighbors have to pay their taxes and pay their fair share, people are a lot better, feel a lot better about it. So it's important to keep after these filing enforcement cases, even if it takes us several years, because these people, unfortunately, drag other people into it and cause them to invest their retirement, their life savings, and lose it and become involved in tax situations. We recently had an issue with a trust over in Eastern Oregon that was resolved, and that one, unfortunately, went on for many, many years, involved many people, and actually, there were taxpayers who committed suicide. One gentleman did because he invested all of his retirement and all of his income in this trust and then owed all these taxes. So that was a large amount of money on the table with some of these issues. And so when you just look at the sheer numbers that we were talking about, you were talking about the other day, we wanted to give you...
your view of Council 3509. The department does collect about 97% of all tax deficiencies assessed, so we have a pretty good track record over time. We do have about $160 million in accounts that have not had a payment in a year. And that sounds like a huge number until you break it down. The $40 million of that is currently right now assigned to private collection agencies. So that's about 40,000 accounts we have out of private collection agencies. We have another $25 million we can't work because it's on legal hold, whether it's bankruptcy or appeals or that type of thing. We cannot do that because of the legal implications. So the remaining $95 million is really what's sitting out there with no payments in a year. And this is primarily hardship in the filing enforcement cases. It does include some other things as well. But these are the tougher cases for us to deal with. And, but we're confident over time we can collect those as well. I talked with you a little bit about these cases previously when we talked about the department's bill for pseudonyms and mail theft. We talked a little bit about the filing enforcement cases. But the hardship ones are probably the more are troubling as well. We have a good example of a recent one of that where you have an older woman who's trying to get her and her husband into compliance, and they were looking to set up a payment plan. Well, unfortunately, he passed away, and this woman has never worked outside the home. So right now, she wants to pay the debt, but she needs a little bit more time to kind of get everything in order and work to pay it off. It's going to take her a little bit of time. But it's important that she pays that and works to get current. The ones that we talked about with you before were the filing enforcement ones. And those sometimes drag on for a long time and are very, there's a lot of money out there right now. And the $95 million, a lot of those probably are filing enforcement cases. They're very complex. They involve trusts oftentimes or individuals who are hiding their assets. So it's not something we can simply send to a private collection agency. And I don't think they probably would want them, as a matter of fact. But that's a large part of the $95 million, the hardships in the filing enforcement. So these are tough cases, but we think it's real important for the health of the system that we keep working on those. We hear from people who complain about paying their taxes all the time, but they grumble a lot. But as long as their neighbor comes to pay their taxes and pay their fair share, people are a lot better, still a lot better about it. So it's important to keep after these filing enforcement cases, even if it takes them several years, because these people unfortunately drag other people into it and cause them to invest their retirement and their life savings and lose it and become involved in tax situations. We recently had an issue with a trust over in Eastern Oregon that was resolved, and that one unfortunately went on for many, many years, involved many people, and actually there was taxpayers who committed suicide, one gentleman did, because he invested all of his retirement and all of his income in this trust and then owed all these taxes. So that was a large amount of money on the table with some of these issues. And so when you just look at the sheer numbers that we were talking about, you were talking about the other day, we wanted to give you a better part of at least the deal with the Department of Revenue.
The reporting requirements under Section 2, do those cause the department any heartburn?
Not at all, Senator Bryant. We'd have to do some little runs and different things to get you the information, but we've looked at it and we can get you the information.
It's important to hear because I would hope the Department of Revenue mm-hmm. would have that recently, what I call age counting
yeah.
information.
We do have it. It's in a slightly different format, so we look to make sure we match the format of the report. But as I say, we're comfortable with what we're doing. We can always do better. Everyone can. But we want to provide the data so you can look at it and see if we're doing an appropriate job in collecting the accounts for you as the legislator, because we feel the accounts that we take on are a little bit different. We did talk with Ways and Means, and I think with your committee in the Interim Center, Brian, the Interim Budget Committee, about Ms. Harshenko has a very strong, clear view that you need a balanced approach to tax administration. You need to have the enforcement side and all the compliance that goes with it, but you also need to help those people who are trying to stay in the system and really just don't understand it and are struggling to make a living and trying to come into compliance and support them as well. So there's those two different groups we need to balance. We were just a little concerned about House Bill 3509 would maybe refocus our efforts at really looking at getting the bucks in versus what does that mean long-term to the people who are trying to come into the system and stay there, and those who absolutely refuse. But we need to get them there because they're presenting a bad example to everyone, and they're roping other people into it as well.
Well, under the bill, too, the accounts that could be assigned are 1 year of basically inactivity, no payment. And your estimate was that was about $97 million?
About $95 million.
$95 million. Yeah. And then, as I understand the bill, you, of course, and there's a lot of exemptions, too, for, like you said, bankruptcy litigation, those sorts of things, but there's also an additional exemption of up to 35%, I believe, of your total account. With that type of an exemption, would the Department of Revenue feel comfortable in assigning out the remainder of the collections, or do you think that would defeat the policy that we've been talking about?
Mr. Chair, we were more comfortable with the dash 6 or dash 7 because the total figure we have that fits within 3509 is about $160 million. We already set aside $40 million outside the collection agencies already, so we took that off. And of the 120, we have about 24, 25 million that's on legal hold. So that is in 3509. The 95 million is basically what's on the table right now. And those don't meet the exceptions that you did and what's in the bill, but they're larger potentially larger than 35 would stand across the globe. But that dash 6 and dash 7 gives staff the latitude and ability to work with us on it, because we believe these hardship and these fine enforcement cases really do not belong at a private collection agency, because they are the types that really are integral to the health of the system.
What percent do you collect on your bills that are over a year delinquent, and by delinquent I mean have not received a payment of any year?
Mr. Chair, our figures are 97% of the accounts receivable, which is about $300 million. So of the $300 million, we collect 97%. That does get more difficult as we get into the fire enforcement cases. As we get into some of those cases of the hardship, we do sometimes have to write off some of the debt because the person's been hiding their assets, so effectively we can't find them, or this is kind of a person just cannot financially paid and can't get themselves on their feet to the point where they're able to pay all of it. But the 97% is of the $300 million total. So the $160 million part of that $300 million. So we've got a pretty good percentage. We're very comfortable with it. But it does take us time, and that's why I was concerned about House Bill 3509, is that the one-year trigger could artificially be moving debt into a private collection agency where basically they would be just turning it around and giving it back to us and not wanting it, or perhaps pursuing people on a hardship condition that perhaps you would not wish them to be doing that with. So I think the Department of Revenue just has a slightly different perspective on this, and that's why we wanted to present that and give that view to you. It was really important to us when we talked with Ways and Means Subcommittee, too, that they did ask us if we could raise more revenue to support the budget piece of it, and we are committed to that, but we don't want to bring in the bucks on the short term that will hurt the system on the long term, and that's our concern about 3509, if DAS does not give us exemption similar to the DASH 6 and DASH 7.
So we're going to have the DASH 8, too. So,
we look at the DASH 8, and it looks very much like DASH 6 and DASH 7 with some other things added on. So we're comfortable with those as well.
Okay, that's
something
good.
We'd like to have.
Are there other questions, Ms. Ben?
Yes.
Senator Carl.
Susan, you've mentioned a couple of times about persons who are going to pay. How do you evaluate a person's ability to pay? How do you rate that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Connell, we have a very detailed financial statement that we ask the individual to fill out. Basically, they have to list all their assets, they have to list their income and their debt, and it's a two-page process. If it's a significant amount, we will sit down and we talk to the person over the phone about that, and then get a sense for other things. A lot of times people don't realize that they have to revise that. And then we look at that. What amount of money can this person pay, you know, and still maintain their life, basically. And we push to get the amount of money that we can out and put people on the payment plan if we possibly can. That's the most effective way. If we feel it's one of these fire enforcement people, a lot of times we will have one of our field agents go out there and actually do a physical assessment to see what the person has and try to find their assets because they won't come forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Susan, what percentage of the time or cases would you send a field agent out there? Given the fact you've got books of bucks out, how often would you send a field agent out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Connell, the fire enforcement agents, we do have them out in field offices. They go out on the more, we have an escalated collection system, so we try to do it through billing letters. That's how most of the money comes in fairly easily. Then it's followed up by phone calls from inside our central office. And once they Chase find out and see if they can find a collection source to garnish, whether it's a bank account or checking account. If that doesn't work and the amount of money is significant enough, we will send it out to a field office and ask someone to look at that. These are more experienced, very professional people with a lot of collection experience. They will look at it and then oftentimes go out and visit the taxpayers physically. So they need, as I mentioned, of all the money we collect, we only, it comes in through the system, probably but about 30% of it comes in voluntarily. So we're only talking about this 300,000. And of that, 160 million, the 95 million I broke away down to, that's where we start getting into the field agents and that type of thing.
That's true. One more question. Is there a formula that you use to exempt a person? In other words, they fill out an affidavit, and is there a formula that you use to say, okay, we're going to exempt you from payments for a while?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carnell, we really look at what the person's long-term ability to pay this is. It's very different if you're 25 and you've lost your job and you have debts or issues to deal with, or you're 70 or 75 and you're basically on Social Security or Medicare and that type of thing. So it really depends on the person's circumstance. If you're 25, you may be going through a bad patch, but you could recover and repay it at a given time. If you're 75 on Social Security, the chances of getting this paid are probably pretty slim. So it really depends on a case by case. And that's why we're a little concerned with House Bill 3509, because in 1 year, you know, one person may be able to, in a year, get back on their feet and repay this if we give them a little bit of time. Other people, maybe it makes sense to charge it off and say, you know, write it off saying, this person exists, we don't want to bother you on Social Security with Medicaid or whatever. It's a little bit different with businesses and withholding, because that's trust fund from employees. That business is actually using someone else's money, their employees' money, to run it. So we really hold them pretty tightly to try and repay that if possible and find the liable officers of the company and pass that along to those individuals. Thank you very much for the courtesy.
You bet. Brian. I'd invite Matt Marquis. I committed we will adjourn tonight at 5 because we have a place to be at 5:50.
You're
going to go on the team bus?
No, I'm here to serve. I go until my work's done.
Probably best served by me.
Duncan, by the way. Mr. Marquis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't remember the committee. I want to vote on the committee on it.
I don't make them any better than that. What are you talking about?
Sorry, you're having to put up with something
here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I would like to testify in support of the A8 amendments to House Bill 3509 and quickly go through them real quick. The first thing it does is redefines what a state agency means for the purposes of this act. And the change here would be it exempts out the Judicial Department. Again, we're going to look at them in a different bill because they didn't really fit under the relating clause of this bill. The next thing that this does is changes shall assign throughout the bill to shall offer to assign. We want to make sure that all state agencies can comply with this, and for whatever reason, if a private collection agency isn't interested or they're unsuccessful in obtaining a bid for these delinquent accounts, this allows them the discretion to not have to assign these accounts over. Furthermore, it takes out the 35% discretion part of the bill and allows full discretion through rules by the Department of Administrative Services. And it also takes out the vendor debtor offset study program, which I discussed last time. I would also just like to make a couple comments from the Department of Revenue. Testimony. I just want to make sure that you guys understand that the hardship accounts that they were talking about were never our intention of those accounts being having to turn over. We think that Dash A8 helped clarify that in allowing more discretion.
Senator Carter,
I don't know the Dash A8.
Yes, they're in your package today.
I would touch
your kids. There's a packet right there. Yeah.
You did steal my packet.
No, I didn't do it. I didn't mean to steal them. We'll get your dash area.
I'll share them with the sheriff.
Somebody stole mine. By George.
even further, I'd just like to point out that the Oregon Accounting Manual that is put together by the Department of Administrative Services recommends that after 90 days, after an account's 90 days old, that these accounts should be turned over either to a private collection agency or to a Department of Revenue. Our bill states 1 year without a payment, so we're talking about a liquidated and delinquent account, which means the account has already gone through all the appeals process to make sure the bill is owed, and then we're talking about 1 year from that point forward without a payment. And if a payment is reached, any type of payment, we're talking one penny as a minimum, that 1 year time frame will start over. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Well, this comment, I think the Dash 88 accomplished a lot of what the DAS was after as far as the discretion, and also the allows the department to adopt the rule for state agencies to proceed. And with the amount of money they're selling, and I realize a lot of it will never be recovered, I think this is an important first step, because it will require agencies to pay more attention to the fact, convert their accounting system to keep track of their receivables and issue regular reports.
Some of the Dash 8 amendments.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Moves the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 5509. Discussion? Objection? Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3509 to forward to pass. Discussion? Objection? I will carry it. Thank you. And we are, I think that was our last one, wasn't it?
But one that's about House Bill 2759 and House Bill 2760. I'd like to be recorded as an aye vote. It will not change the outcome.
Without exception.
Oh, so it's a good thing.
You want that, since you're your judge, it'll
appear. Thank you. I appreciate that.